the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yeah, welcome to the program. It is time yet again for another hour, Bucket Strategy Investing. I would advise you to stand by because you got more of the best in money information coming up in just a moment or two. In fact, it started right now. How's that? Professor Rick Plum, our Brain Trust Advisor in Chief, back with me, Johnny Dean, this hour here from Lucia Capital Group. I said this before, I'll say it again, your participation is required. So you have no choice but to give us a call right now. Got some lines open for you. Our number here in the studio, 877-PLANNER. That's 877-752-6637. My second piece of advice to you this hour. Take full advantage of everything the Brain Trust has to offer. You can either call us or you can send us an email at wealthed.com. Those emails get to us right there through the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page at wealthed.com. In fact, I think maybe I've got a couple of RMD things to talk about here, but we will get to those emails shortly. Now, our goal here on this show is to deliver to you what we believe to be the best in money information. We do this every day, and I think it's what we do best on this show. You can get in touch with the Brain Trust, both off the air and on the air. Now, if you want to set up a face-to-face meeting with an advisor, you hear something on the show, see something that you have questions on, you want to schedule an appointment, maybe you just have a question or two, whatever, that needs to be answered, you can call Professor Plum or any of the advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Their phone number, 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150, that's the number off the air. Your individual goals, your unique needs, they all require a financial plan that is uniquely tailored to you. And that's what the advisors do. They've made themselves available to go over your plans, your goals, your individual situation, and devise a strategy, a bucket strategy, that potentially could work for you. So again, their number, 800-644-1150, off the air, on the air, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We were talking in a previous hour about required minimum distributions, Professor Plum. We had some calls, so we really didn't get into everything that we wanted to talk about. So I thought, let's just sort of,
expand?
Yeah, just for a bit, because what we're about on this program is strategy. We talk strategy. And you can actually work some strategy around the required minimum distribution, can you not?
Well, when you're looking at it, and before you get to the required minimum distribution age, you should be looking at how much income do you need from your portfolio. Now, this is going to assume that you need to take at least some amount of income from your portfolio. The people that really dislike the required minimum distribution are the people who have absolutely no need to take any money out of their portfolio and therefore are being forced to create a taxable event when they don't need the income in the first place. But for most of us, we're going to need to take some amount of income from our portfolio. And the reality is our portfolios should be invested and earning some amount of return. Where that return is coming from differs by investment, but some amount of return is going to be taxable. So how we go about building the required minimum distribution into our overall strategy dictates what we're going to deal with. Unfortunately, a lot of people try to not think about the taxation of the IRA. It's like, if I just ignore it, it'll go away. No, it won't go away. And in fact, if you're actually investing the money appropriately, it'll probably only get worse if you ignore it until you're right at the threshold of the required minimum distribution age. And now you don't have a choice. So typically it makes a little bit more sense to start looking at it before you retire and using it to meet your required minimum distributions, but also to meet your income needs. The IRA distributions are taxed as ordinary income. Now, ordinary income is the tax brackets we all have, the 10, 15, 25, 28, 33, and on up the way. So if we have assets in our overall investment portfolio that create ordinary income, non-qualified dividends, what they call ordinary dividends, passive income from other from real estate and other things, interest, yeah, all those are treated as ordinary income. So if I have $5,000 of ordinary income and or I had $5,000 of an IRA distribution, the tax treatment is exactly the same on both those types of income. They're both ordinary income. So from an overall portfolio location standpoint, if I can get my IRA to create that ordinary income, I can use that ordinary income to help satisfy the required minimum distribution. Rather than investing my personal account to create that ordinary income, that $5,000 in this hypothetical example, and then being taxed on that $5,000 and then having to take a distribution from my IRA that may be coming from stocks, it may be coming from any other source, whether it's principal, long-term capital gains, qualified
right.
dividends, something that would have been taxed at a lower bracket. But because I have to take it out of my IRA, it's being taxed as ordinary income. I just doubled up on my taxation. So in many respects, if we can look in how we're building our income stream, we can manage, at least to some degree, the taxable event that's happening on the required minimum distribution.
So what you're saying is you want to be able to take advantage of the, say, the capital gains tax rates where you can.
Potentially, yes.
And where there's no choice but to take ordinary income rates, you might be able to, you know.
Well, you got to figure that somebody who's 65 or older, 60 or older, they're going to, and that needs some kind of distribution from their portfolio,
right.
They're not going to be 100% in stocks. They shouldn't be 100% in stocks. So some of their money is going to be invested in other assets, and these other assets are going to potentially create ordinary income. Well, those ordinary income items should be in your IRA, not your personal account. And so the other side of it, it works that means that the growth assets should be in my personal account, not my IRA. Because once you get out to that age, obviously when you're 35, 40, you're trying to grow your portfolio as much as possible. And the majority of your assets are probably in the IRAs. So that's where your growth is happening. And it does make some sense, even from a tax standpoint, at that point, because yep. we're not earning anything on our safe accounts.
Right.
But when we get out to 65, 70 years of age, if I've got personal money and I've got IRA money, where do I want my growth to happen? My allocation needs to have safer, less volatile, ordinary income producing assets and growth assets. That's my allocation calls for that based on everything I'm trying to achieve from an investment standpoint. And from a tax standpoint, where do I want my growth? If you read the journalists, they say never touch your IRA, let it grow as long as possible, build up as much possible there and let it go, let it go, let it go. Once you get out to the RMD age, that's not where you want it. If you're going to have if you have a 2013 year, where the stock market did as well as it did. It grew very nicely, 30% basically. Do you want that in your IRA or do you want that in your personal account? Frankly, I'd rather have it in my personal account because if I had $130,000 or $100,000 at the beginning of the year that my required minimum distribution was set on, that's about a $4,000 required minimum distribution. And then it jumps by 30% inside the account. Even after taking a required minimum distribution, my account balance is now $126,000. My required minimum distribution just went up by quite a bit. It was a much larger required minimum distribution. However, if I had that money in my personal account, my RMD is much more manageable. So from a growth standpoint, first and foremost, you set your allocation up, and then you decide where to put the assets in the IRA or non-IRA. And if I'm going to have growth assets, in most cases, and again, this isn't across the line, you know, black and white, everybody do it the same way. But most of the time, I'm going to want that growth in my personal account
okay.
so that I don't create even larger required minimum distributions in the future. I still get the growth either way. It's just more manageable from a tax standpoint.
Right. Now, you said, okay, for the most part, if you're in the 30s, 35, 40, you're going to have most of your growth is going to be in your IRA, your 401k, one of those tax-deferred accounts. Where should you be thinking about perhaps now locating them differently?
When you're getting in, well, a lot of times when you get into your 50s, you're saving money. You're maxing out your 401k, and now you're also saving additional monies because you're looking at that retirement income need 10 years away, 12, 15 years away, whatever the number is. And you're saying, I need to save more than $24,000, which my 401k allows, 50 and older. So you start building up personal assets as well. So at that point, you're still probably doing both growth in both areas and still trying to build. And then as you get closer to retirement, you're pulling back the aggressiveness. In many cases, you're pulling it back inside the IRA. Well, for one reason, because I can sell things and move them without creating a taxable event to safer areas and let my personal accounts continue to grow. Most people are still married, and so they want the step up in basis. So there's a lot going on. But as you get closer to retirement, you pull back the aggressiveness of the tax deferred accounts so that when you do retire, you can start taking your income from those areas. Again, it's not perfect, and some people will do it a little bit on both sides to try to manage that overall taxability.
Yeah.
So they manage where they're going to be on the tax brackets when they get into retirement rather than just taking pot luck when you get out there.
Yeah, and this becomes really important, especially as you get into your late 50s, early 60s, and you know that at age 70 and a half, it's
required all, minimum distribution.
This
age.
Is all going to come out. Exactly. And if you're required to all of a sudden take a whole bunch of money at ordinary income rates.
Yeah. And at every level of income, there is something, I've said this many times before, there's something to look out for on the tax code. If you are in that $30,000 to $50,000, $60,000 range as a single individual, you've got to worry about the impact of Social Security taxation. You know, $45,000, $50,000 to $100,000 maybe for a married couple. You got to worry about the impact of the taxable event happening on your Social Security. Once you get over, you know, 100, you got to worry about jumping brackets. You know, once you get over 170, you got to worry about paying more on your, this is for a married couple, more on your Medicare premium. Once you get over 250, yeah, you got to worry about the net investment income tax. I mean, there's something all along the way.
That's a lot of information right there that we packed into that. If you have questions on it, you can give us a call, or just you can talk to Professor Plum about it. It's why we do what we do. It's why advisors should be helping you out with this stuff as you approach retirement. It's important. Okay, 877-PLANNER, emails. Talking about Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, here with you once again, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. Here talking to you about your money, your business, your life, all that stuff. If you want to email us, you go to our website, wealthed.com, wealthed.com. In fact, let's get to a couple of these here because they are stacking up. They are backing up and stacking up. Let's see, Jeff in Scottsdale, Arizona with a question. Hi, guys. Love the show. Thank you, Jeff. I have a rental home held in an LLC, limited liability company. And I want to know if I use the collected rent to pay the mortgage, maintenance expenses, and remodeling improvements, can I show a zero income or even a loss off of that property? Can a loss pass through to offset personal income?
Well, Jeff, yes. And that's one of the reasons people like having rental property, because they can use all the potential expenses for maintaining that rental property as a deduction against the income that you're receiving from it. Maybe you're renting it out for $2,000 a month. Now, when you're making a mortgage payment, not the entire mortgage payment is deductible. Only the interest is deductible. The principal is not a deductible expense. But the interest that I'm paying there, ongoing maintenance expenses, mostly the repairs that I'm doing, although some repairs like a roof or some other things need to be capitalized over a series of years, but I get to take those as deductions against the income that I'm receiving. And it's not even just the physical dollars for things that I'm spending. You know, let's say I rent it out for $2,000 a month and I have exactly $2,000 a month of deductible expenses. So I have a zero cash flow, from a deductible expense. I actually, maybe it's an interest-only loan we'll talk about right here. So everything that I put out, on expenses was deductible, and I'm washed exactly zero on the cash coming in and the expenses going out. In addition to that, depending upon what my income is from other sources, I have a depreciation expense I can take. So I can show a negative number, even though I didn't have a cash flow item to go along with it, and I can take that negative number. And as long as all the accounting comes out and it shows a negative number, I can bring that over to my 1040, and I can reduce other incomes. Now, it's not an unlimited issue. I can't have so much real estate that I'm a passive investor in and show $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 of tax losses and bring it over to offset $100,000 of my wages or whatever. So for most people, the most they can use is a minus $25,000 of tax losses from my rental property. Now, I say for most people, assuming you have at least $25,000 of losses, whether you can use the whole $25,000 or not depends on other incomes. If you have $100,000 of other income or less, you can use up to $25,000 of passive losses to offset those other incomes. But once I go over $100,000 of adjusted gross income, then I start losing the ability to show a loss on my tax return. And it's phased out over a $50,000 period. So if I've got more than $150,000 of other incomes, I can't show a negative. Now, I can still use it to offset all the income that I'm using or receiving from that rental property. I just won't be able to use a negative income from all the rental properties to offset other incomes. I
have once
to
you hit,
carry that $150,000.
Of income.
Of other incomes.
Of other income, non-rental.
Non-passive incomes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and it's, this is why accountants have jobs, keeping track of all this stuff. And bless their heart for doing it. But it's, it has to do with what I'm doing as far as, yes, you can in many cases. Now, if you tell me that, and you can prove to me, or not actually prove to me, prove to the IRS, that you are a real estate professional, then that $25,000 cap and that $100,000-$150,000 phase out doesn't exist anymore. You can use whatever losses there are to offset other incomes. And so, but to be a real estate professional, you got to really be in the real estate game. And if you have a day job where you're working 40 hours a week, it's very, very, very hard to, all, assuming that's not real estate, also be called a real estate professional in the other side of life.
Yeah.
Because you have to spend more than half your time doing real estate.
There's a certain number of hours in the week or the year or the month or something that you have to be spending on that particular.
And it has to be more than half of your work life.
Exactly.
So you can use it. And in fact, you are supposed to use those to offset the incomes. It's one of the benefits of owning real estate.
That's right. If you don't, then, you know, tough
then you're
luck,
missing
I
out.
Guess. Sure, you're missing out.
And the other side, if you don't use the depreciation and you don't show it on your tax return the right way,
that's even worse.
The IRS is going to assume you did, and they're going to recapture it anyway. So have an accountant do it right for you.
There you go. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER. Jeff, thank you for the email. Let's move along to, Daniel in American Canyon, California. I will be retiring July this year. And I have a 401k in my company, about $455,000. My question is, I need to roll over to an IRA. Do I need to pay taxes from the rollover?
Well, if you transfer it directly to an IRA, you go from the 401k to the IRA, you don't have the money come to you directly, then it's a non-taxable event. The money's over in an IRA waiting for you to withdraw it from the IRA and then be taxed when you withdraw it from the IRA.
Well, okay, so now Daniel says, also after transferring to an IRA, can I withdraw $1,500 monthly to supplement my pension and I think Social Security to pay my mortgage? Do I pay tax monthly on the $1,500 withdrawal on my IRA? He's got a couple more questions.
You can do that. That's a very reasonable distribution pattern from a $450,000 account. That's about $18,000 a year on $450,000. That's a 4% distribution. It's right in line with most guidelines that we're looking at, and I think it's a reasonable goal, assuming you do it correctly. It should last for the rest of your life without too much trouble. No guarantees on anything in life. And yes, when you pull the money out, it will be taxable in the year you pull it out. Now, I would suggest, so that you don't miss the withholding requirements, you might as well figure out what your taxes are going to be for the end of the year. And if you're withholding it from your pension, if you're withholding it from your Social Security, maybe you don't need to withhold so much or anything from the IRA. However, most people don't have anything withheld from their pension. They don't have anything withheld from their IRAs. So they do withhold it from their IRA. When the money's coming out, you just tell them withhold 15, 20, 25, 30, whatever the number is. I was working with somebody the other day determining it, and they have money coming in from multiple different sources. And because of what they were withholding through their pensions and Social Security, they just needed to withhold 15% from a federal standpoint on their IRA distribution. But because their pension was coming from a state outside of, they moved to California. California will tax the pension. They were getting a pension from another state, and that state didn't tax pensions. So that state won't withhold anything on their pension. So to make up for the fact that they're receiving a bunch of money from a pension that doesn't do any withholding, from a state standpoint, they were going to have to increase their California withholding on their IRA distribution to like 25%. And so it was just a matter of, you need to do the withholding from somewhere or pay quarterly payments. It has to be paid in. So you either have a choice of having it withheld from the checks that you're receiving or have it done through a quarterly payment system.
Yeah.
Personally, I like it having withholding it from the checks. I hate writing the quarterlies. That's just me, though.
Well, that's in that case, it's sort of, you know, it's done. It's out of sight. It's like property taxes or something. You know, I prefer to just have somebody else take care of it for me. Impound it. Let's
right.
do it that
it's,
way.
It's simple. It's easy. And for whatever reason, this last time I bought a house, I didn't do that.
Why not?
I didn't.
I didn't do it the first time I bought a house either. I used to have to write a check, and it was always like, I got to come up with this money.
Oh, I did, and this time I didn't. And this time it's a bigger check.
Of course it's a bigger check, and you got to write it twice.
Yes.
Twice a
or
year.
Transfer it twice.
Well, whatever it is you got to do now. I don't even
write
know how
a check?
It's done. What's a check?
How old are you?
Old enough. 877-PLANNER, our number. PLAW. Title?
Oh yeah, I've heard this. Never this arrangement though.
Okay, all right. It's not Martha.
No, that's what I'm using.
Martha Reed. There you go. All right. 877-PLANNER, PLAWNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum here for you, taking your calls. 877-752-6637, and some more emails as well. In fact, we'll do one more here before we get to a couple of other things that I wanted to talk to so that we can get through some of these emails. We have been stacking them up here. Let's find one here. Sam in San Jose. Let's see if I can make this work. By the way, wealthed.com, our website, if you want to email us. Recently, I was applying for a life insurance policy. I had to answer too many medical and health-related questions. Okay.
You didn't like answering them, huh?
Well, this reminded me about a life insurance, I guess, policy I had bought 10 years back. And at that time, I was asked many medical and health-related questions over the phone. I was not aware about that time, but I think I may not have answered all the questions accurately, and I may not have disclosed all my medical conditions and medications correctly. However, I went through the tests that the insurance companies make you do. My question is that if I may happen to not answer all the questions correctly and not disclose some medical conditions, can an insurance company use this as a reason to deny any claim in case I pass away? Is there a time limit after which an insurance company cannot use this as a reason to deny a claim? This time I saw that they had some clause which states that if any of the answers are not correct, the policy may be invalid. So I guess...
Well, there is a time. There's an incontestability period. And right off the top of my head, I can't remember if it's
2 or 3 years.
It's 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But now, obviously, try to answer the questions as honestly as possible. But there's a lot of times where we forget something. I forgot that I had a cold or whatever. I don't know what they're going to ask. But be as honest as possible and don't try to commit fraud. But there is a certain period of time. And if they don't find out that you lied on the application within that period of time, then they can't hold it against you. But if you die in the period of time where it's there and they find out that what you lied on actually had an issue on why you died, they could deny the claim during that period. So if they find out, if you lied that you'd never had, you said, my heart is perfect, it's as strong as a bull, and they, but reality was you had a, quadruple bypass a couple of years back, and then you die of a heart attack in the next, 2 years, they're going to deny that claim because you're in the contestability period and you lied on the app. Or whether you lied or forgot about it, or whatever you want to call it, it was incorrect information. But once you get past a certain amount of time, I don't believe that there's any way for them to deny the claim. Same as like a suicide clause.
Yeah, that's the same thing. And I think that might also be 2 years.
I think the suicide is 2 years, that contemplation of death type issues. If you buy a life insurance policy with the idea that you're going to, pay your family back for all the trouble you caused them or whatever, and then unfortunately commit suicide, they don't, in many cases, pay off. But after a series of years, even that will, be paid off. So there is a time period, and it is in the fine print. It is in the policy. It is one of the reasons why they give you 30 days once you receive the policy to read it over, learn everything about it, understand what's going on. And if you don't like what's in the policy, you can give it back to them and get all your money back if you paid any money. So,
that's right. Yeah, you would be able to do that if you decide. They'll pay you every penny you paid.
Right. But after, if you wait past the 30 days, and it's different in states. Some states are only 10 days. If you get past that free look period, what they call it, then you're surrendering the policy. You're not giving it back to them and saying, I don't want it at all. You're basically saying, I know I took it out, but I want to surrender it now. And usually, at that quick of a surrender, you're not getting anything back.
Now, I wonder if they deny a claim the way that Sam is asking here in San Jose, and you paid premiums for 2 years, and they say no because you had a heart attack before and you didn't tell us. I wonder if they give you back your premiums.
Most of the time, they'll give you back your premiums.
So, because it's as if the contract were never enforced at all.
That's what I've heard.
Because it was invalid.
I've never been involved with anybody that's been through that.
Something I'm wondering.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. Okay.
No interest on it.
No interest on it.
On the premiums you pay.
I'd like 5% interest, please, per year. Yeah, good luck with that. Insurance companies? Are they really, are they out to make a buck? Are they trying to get a profit? I don't think so. All right, Sam, I hope that helps you out. We'll get to some more emails in just a little bit. 877-PLANNER is our number, PLANNER. One last thing on these required minimum distributions, Professor Plum. That I should mention, and I think you need to address. And again, it's just briefly. We talked about how when you have to take a required minimum distribution out, if it's especially large, it could affect the taxation on your Social Security.
Sure.
It could subject your Social Security to taxation, whether it's 50 or 85%. What about for something like Medicare Part B or Medicare Part D, the premiums that you might be paying with those?
Well, Medicare Part B is means tested. The more money you make, once you get over certain thresholds, the more you pay for that Medicare Part B, C, or D premium. Currently, for somebody signing up for Medicare today, it's around $123 a month for Medicare Part B. But if your income 2 years ago was over $170,000 as a married couple filing a joint return, or $85,000 as a single individual, you get the privilege of paying a higher premium for your Medicare Part B insurance. How much more? Well, it depends on how far above the thresholds you are. There's steps. It could be as much as $400 a month, I think. I can't remember the very top level. You have to be making pretty good money for that, but it could happen. And if you're a married couple and you go over the 170 threshold of adjusted gross income, that's before your deductions, your medical expenses, and all those other things, that's per person. It goes up quite a bit per person. You may be paying $3,000, $4,000 a year or more in premiums for the same coverage as anybody else gets. Now, why is it means tested? Who knows why? That's just Congress's rules. But the premium we are actually paying for Medicare is, for the average person, that 123 that I just mentioned, or if you were taking it last year with your benefit, it was only 105. That's only 25% of the actual annual cost for the Medicare Part B premium. And what has been going on for years is that the government only charges us 25% of the actual cost for Medicare Part B. It supplements the other 75%. But what they say is that for rich people, people that have more than certain thresholds of income, they have the opportunity to pay more for their Medicare Part B. And so it scales up to a point where they could pay as much as 80%, I think is the highest number, of the actual Medicare premium.
What do you mean, pay as much as 80% more?
No, let's say that the premium is $100 right now. So the real premium is $400. Average person be charged $100. At the very high end, regardless of, if your income was $1 million a year, you may be paying 80% of that $400 or $320 versus. So I don't remember the exact percentages, but it could go up quite a bit. Uh-huh. And so it is one of those things to potentially look out for when you're dealing with having to take large required minimum distributions. Or it also catches a lot of people by surprise if they sell an asset, a piece of property, a vacation house, and they realize a couple $100,000 worth of gain on this vacation house that they just don't use anymore, and they haven't been able to get to it, the family doesn't use it anymore for whatever reason, they have $100,000, $200,000 of gain, and it's on their tax return. They know that they have to pay taxes on it for the year of the gain. They know that their Social Security may be taxable because of it in the year of the gain, but then the next year goes by and nothing. The following year, usually 2 years after the large gain happens, they get a note from the Social Security Administration says, oh, by the way, since your income in that year was so high, you went over the thresholds, you're going to pay more for your Medicare Part B premium for the next year. And you think, wait, I don't have the income this year. My income's back down to almost nothing, but I still have to pay more? Uh-huh. Yeah, you do. The only exceptions to that are somebody who is working and receiving Social Security, or somebody who's working and then retires and starts receiving Social Security. That's an exception when there's a death, divorce, change of job situation. They don't look back the 2 years on that one to hit you with the higher incomes. But most of the time, they're looking back 2 years to see what your premium is going to be for your Medicare this year. And so if you come into it and you all of a sudden jump your tax bill because you have a very large required minimum distribution, That would presume that you're going to have that required minimum distribution every year going forward. It's going to affect your premium on your Medicare insurance going forward every year. So a lot of people will look at that and say, well, that's a good enough reason right there to start doing conversions and try to bring down my overall IRA
right.
balance to be able to bring down my required minimum distribution or get married to somebody that's 25 years old, because then you can stretch it out over a longer period of time.
25 and you're 60?
Oh, 70.
Your
RMDs are 70.
At 70. That's right, 70 and a half, yeah.
Or older.
I was saying thinking about it at age 60, but that's true. Now, you should be thinking about this stuff once again, 10 years in advance of required minimum distribution. I mean, there are a lot of people who hear about required minimum distributions, but they're not really thinking about them, and it creeps up on them. And by the time they hit that stage,
once
all of a sudden they're in a huge tax bracket.
Once you get there, there's really very little you can do about it, except for maybe accelerating the tax even more by doing conversions on any amount over and above the required minimum distribution. Remember, you cannot convert the amount equal to the required minimum distribution. You can only convert amounts in excess of that once you get to required minimum distribution age. But it may actually make sense. Maybe you've got room in the tax bracket. You might as well pay it now and try to reduce the overall balance as time goes forward.
Yeah, but you think that if you'd done it 10 years earlier, you could have spent maybe the lower bracket instead of the bracket that you've been pushed into because of the high RMD.
But maybe you were working for those years and you didn't have that opportunity because you were even a higher tax bracket.
Yeah, I never know. Okay, there you go. Your Friday dose of faces. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Let's have to let the whole song play at some point, you know.
No, because I get bored of it, but that intro is just awesome.
Oh, no, it's a great song. It's a great song. 877-752-6637. I want to remind you very quickly, another workshop coming up, a series of workshops. It's the spring, whatever, I don't know. It's the spring series of retirement income strategies workshops. The next one is happening on February 20th. It is in Las Vegas, Nevada. So join the Brain Trust for the Lucia Capital Group 2016 Retirement Income Strategies Workshop. Professor Plum will be there. Terry Keyes, whom you've heard on this program many times before, will also be there talking to you about your money and your income strategies. So Las Vegas, Saturday, February 20th. We got Seattle, Washington, Saturday, February 27th. And Phoenix, Arizona, March 12th. Those are the next three. Las Vegas, Seattle, and Phoenix. There will be more after that throughout March and into April as well. So if you want to find out more and you need to know right now, find out, go to wealtheds.com, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealtheds.com. Sign up there too. It's all free. No money required. Just bring your money questions and bring maybe a pen and pencil or something. I don't know.
I usually provide those.
Okay, well, we'll even give you that. What more could you want?
Usually.
All right, not always. That's not a guarantee, okay?
Nothing's a guarantee.
No. You potentially could have paper and pencil. No, seriously, you're going to really learn something, and they're a whole lot of fun. So, wealtheds.com. Back to the phone lines, 877-PLANNER. We'll try to get to an email, too, but we're going to talk to Raj up next in Portland, Oregon. Hello, Raj.
Hey, hi. How are you?
Very well. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
So, what's up?
So, my question is... I recently started investing in the 401k, and I've been investing in the stock as well. So is it wise to invest more in the stock or more in the 401k?
Well, you're talking about investing in the stock of the company outside of the 401k and also investing in the 401k?
Stocks in the company, the ESPP.
Oh, the employee stock purchase plan. Well, it kind of depends on what you're trying to save for. I actually like both of them, but the ESPP, the Employee Stock Purchase Plan, is done with after-tax money and is not part of the 401k, and I'll ultimately pay some taxes when I sell that. But I'm not limited to holding on to it until I'm 55 or 59 or older. It's not a long-term retirement account, but it is a stock investment. So if I'm looking for something that I could potentially use before I get to 59 and a half, something I could use potentially maybe for house purchase 5, 10, 15 years, education for my kids down the line, not something this short-term but long-term, Yeah, it could make a lot of sense to do the ESPP. Now, I would want to do the 401k up to the match. I like free money. And then I like doing some ESPP, and I like balancing it out between the two of them. Now, the employee stock purchase plan gives you a discount on the shares. And so it typically, even if you were to sell them right away, which would create ordinary income on the gain of the sale, at least you get some gain on the sale usually. So I like them for longer term investments, but the fact that you're usually buying them at a discount, a fairly nice discount, 10-15%, from usually a lowest point over the last 6 months, means you've got usually a built-in gain right there. I like the ESPP, but I like free money in the 401k, so I want to do them both.
Yeah, I'm doing both, but so it's kind of, I'm doing kind of 15% in my stocks and kind of 6% in my 401k because I'm just matching my employer. So should I bump in more into the 401k or just stick to the same level what I have?
Well, I always try to push my savings a little bit more, and I'm going to go back to when might I want this money? If I want access to the money before I retire, before I get to 59.5, before I can get to the 401k money, then I'm going to bump up the ESPP. On the other side, if I'm making $500,000 a year and I'm in a really nasty high tax bracket now and I don't expect to be that high in the future, I'm going to pump up the 401k to the maximum. Of course, if you're making $500,000 a year, you can afford to pump them both up.
Well, so, are you in a high tax bracket like that, Raj?
No. Okay. I'm just in the kind of 100.
Okay.
A little over 100. Yeah.
And are you married?
Yeah, I'm married and I have just two small kids, 5 and 2.
And what's the total household income?
We are kind of 150.
So you're in the 25% bracket, maybe, you know, not by much. So, you know, it depends on when you want to use the money. I do like the ESPP. The problem with the ESPP is you are concentrated in one stock, and it's your employer stock. And so your current income is tied to that employer. Your future income is tied to that employer's stock. So you don't want to get too carried away. So I would like to do, obviously, both and build up both of them. But I like the ESPP, especially if I need some money. And you got little ones, 2 and 5 years old. Take it from John and I, about 15 years, 14 years from now, you're going to be spending some money on education, and it'd be nice to be able to have some money saved up for that can give you capital gains treatment.
Yeah. And I'm doing matching my employer percentage in the 401k as well.
I would keep pushing both of them. I would keep do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Just keep pushing them both,
if you can.
Sure. Yeah. I'm doing it. Yeah. And one last thing on the same line. So what about the Roth IRA?
Well, yes, you're eligible for a Roth IRA. So do I do the ESPP, which has a discount on it up front, but taxable income on the appreciation,
or do I do
the Roth IRA, which doesn't give me the discount,
but gives you the
appreciation. Gives me tax free. Dang, that's a good one. If it were retirement money, and I wasn't going to touch it until I'm, you know, older than even me, I do the Roth.
Yeah.
Is this retirement money?
It also depends on the stock, too. I mean, you could always buy the stock inside the Roth. You just don't get the discount on it.
But you get the tax-free growth, potentially.
Tax-free. Yeah. Wow. If I need the money before retirement, I'm going to do the ESPP. If it's retirement money I don't need to touch until I'm 59.5, I'll do the Roth.
Perfect.
Okay.
I just got it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Okay. Raj, thank you for the call. If you have any other questions, hold on.
The trick is to max them all out.
Sure. You got unlimited funds. You know, why not? This shows that, you know, once again, as a planner, you're saying, boy, what is the ultimate goal with this?
Right.
And if this, and then. But there are a couple of different ways you could go.
And it's all of them are good choices. All of them have advantages. All of them have disadvantages.
Yes, and taxes will play a role at some point, but not knowing everything about Raj's situation, we really couldn't make a decision. But those are the choices. All right, we're out of time for this hour. If you need the Brain Trust anytime off the air, you can reach Professor Plum or any of the Brain Trust advisors at Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150. For Professor Rick Plum, I am Johnny Dean. This is Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a